Okay. I don't have to pay attention. Yeah, right about quarter after, I guess. I almost don't know where to begin. When you're talking the history of Presbyterianism and you're talking about Scotland, it's really hard to get out of Scotland. But we're going to have to eventually, because American Puritanism, Presbyterianism is derived primarily from the Puritans of England. Most of the Puritan or most of the Presbyterian denominations in America would trace their history not necessarily back to Scotland, but Scotland has such a huge impact, and our denomination certainly traces back to Scotland. All the Reformed Presbyterian churches do or claim to. Back to the a group called the Covenanters, and we haven't even got that. But I'm working. And it is interesting to see that there are going to be different streams of Reformed churches that come together in the United States and in colonial America too, as Presbyterian churches. And most of them, I'd say the majority of them, are going to come from England, or from Scotland, or a combination of those two. But a goodly number are actually going to come out of New England Puritanism too, a result of controversy and heresy that creeps into the Congregationalist churches, and their home is going to be. So we'll get around that sometime this year. I don't know when, but sometime. And so I, my notes, you know, I do that, and we visit lots of interesting. Are part of the church, which is unordered, depraved. These great in the world. Reforming century, well into the visit, and it's called, and it's not that church had fallen into ruin. Information. Going to be one of the very first church that was there. actually. Scotland has people sitting on all four sides with the panels. Normally a and there's a lord that somebody with blue blood in the congregation who's financing everything, and he gets privileges. In fact, that becomes a characteristic of a different conservative. More that, and then it would be and pew on Sunday, but it's not really connected to his morality. And so the elders, of which he's probably one, in order to take communion, your head to fit your profession. A publicly you don't qualify to take communion unless you repent. And the aristocracy need to repent of it. Church had to wrestle with that too. Standard practice. Paul.
That church today. Build another church, which we know as Lord Hill.
Comes to the lot. And then practically in terms of you know, to try and just about Burnt Island and to teach church history. To, I think, 1625 or so. Yeah. He says but porch from great deal. And they end up in Florida and Andrew Melville. And the earthly king is Jesus' subject. And James, undeterred, said that he was the head of the church. And the king, while he understands what Melville is saying, that he is subordinate to Christ, is that whatever King James says, because he's the head of the church on earth, he's like the Pope. You know, he's God's vice regent who's been placed in authority over the church. And he rules the church by the bishops and the archbishops that he appoints to rule over the church. And so that's James's position. And Melville eventually unites the two kingdoms, Scotland and England, into one nation, and then seeks to unite the church, the Anglican Church, with him as the head, with the Presbyterian Church in Scotland. And by the way he does it is he appoints bishops over the Scottish Kirk. There's a bishop in Edinburgh, there's one in Glasgow, there's one in Perth, and he puts men in positions at the universities, at St. Andrews, at Glasgow, at some of the other universities of Scotland, but St. Andrews being the most important, he puts his men in place there. And so, control the educational system, control the church, and the state then can dictate whatever they want, and the church will obey through the bishops. And if they don't, then the king's wrath will be kindled, and the talk is always of treason. You deny the authority of the state over the church, you're committing treason. And that's going to become a capital offense in a few short years after James dies. And he passes that aspiration onto his son, Charles, who's not as clever, and he's not as orthodox as his father, James I. James I, at least, is a Calvinist. Now, he's probably a reprobate, too. But he was trained, remember, by Buchanan, and he knows his theology and fancies himself a pretty good theologian, and he likes theological debate. But when it comes right down to it, King James assembles a bunch of ministers, Anglican and Presbyterian, and makes the lovely statement that, quote, "Presbyterianism agrees with monarchy as God does with the devil." So we see that not all Calvinists are Presbyterians in hearts, and certainly King James was not. Melville himself was finally imprisoned by King James for 4 years, and then he was banished and lived out the rest of his life in Holland. The bishops were consecrated in London, sent to take charge of the church, and the king made one visit back to, I think I mentioned that he never came back to Scotland. He did one time. He came back in 1618, and they met in Perth, in the city of Perth, and there they presented to the Scottish church, to the Presbyterian church, the Articles of Perth, as they're called. And the Articles of Perth, let's see, I jot down some of those, yes, which tried to install in the Presbyterian church the rites of confirmation, kneeling in the front to receive the Eucharist, private baptism of children in their homes, and other practices in which Scottish Protestants objected strenuously to. So the Articles of Perth became something that the conservative Presbyterians in Scotland opposed, and that was most ministers, most Scottish ministers. Well, in 1625, King James died, and his son Charles took the throne, and he becomes Charles the First. And we're about to get Charles the Fourth, right? Isn't that what we have in England now? Is it Charles the Fourth or Charles the Third? I think Charles the Third, actually. Charles the First is going to be the son of King James, and Charles the Second is going to be the son of Charles the First, and the current Charles, King Charles, is, I think he's Charles the Third. I don't think they had another Charlie for a while until now, and it's been a slowly downhill progression of quality until they have reached rock bottom with the current monarch. Charles I believed in the divine right of kings, the divine right of monarchy. He resolved to subject Scottish Presbyterians and English Puritans. I'm going to bring them on the scene now, and they're going to dominate the scene for centuries, for a century, you might say, in both England and America, the English Puritans. And remember I mentioned before that these were the men who believed Reformation theology. They were almost all of them Calvinists of the deepest dye. They were, as a rule, wonderful preachers, and some of them spectacular theologians as well. And we are still reading their sermons and their theological works and their practical applications. Throughout the 17th century, these men are going to dominate the English church. And some call the Scottish Covenanters Scottish Puritans, because doctrinally, they're pretty uniformly on the same page, except that the Puritans belong to the Church of England. They are not Presbyterian in church polity. And that is going to change, but only for a very short while. In fact, it's not going to, the change is going to be imperceptible, as it turned out. with the Solemn League and Covenant, which is going to be struck between Scotland and England. And I have a copy of it here somewhere in the building. When we get to it, I will show it to you.
Is it? Yeah, it's in the back.
It's in the back, okay. Yeah, I brought it last time to talk about it and didn't get around to it, and I'm not going to today either. But eventually I will. So unlike his father, Charles I is an Arminian in his theology. He rejects Calvinism. And I have to assume here that you have a working knowledge of what that means, what Calvinism is, as it applies to the Reformation and to our doctrine. And he appoints an Arminian, a fellow rejecter of sovereign grace, to the archbishopric. William Laud is appointed to Archbishop of Canterbury, and he's the highest ranking ecclesiastic in England. And so Laud begins a systematic program to force the Presbyterians of Scotland to conform to the ecclesiology of episcopacy, or what is also sometimes called Erastianism, in which the church and the state are very closely wedded under the authority of the monarchy. So the divine right monarchy and the idea that episcopal style of worship using prayer books and directories of worship and following the liturgical rubrics that came right out of the Roman Catholic Church originally, and they've been modified theologically a little bit, but the liturgy itself, the form of it, has been retained by the King of England and by the English Church. And so episcopacy is the rule by bishops, and when it comes to worship, the RTW, the regulative principle of worship, is not in agreement with the archbishop, the king, or his bishops. And so they composed the Book of Common Prayer, and it's called the Book of Common Prayer and Administration of the Sacraments and Other Parts of Divine Service for the Use of the Church of Scotland. And the Book of Common Prayer was adjusted a little bit for Scotland to make it sound like a little more conforming to Presbyterian theology, to Calvinism. But it was as I said, a liturgical rubric that they would follow for the order of the service and what had to be repeated in worship each time, and was read and memorized by the congregation and by the bishops and their appointed ministers. And it, to Scotland, it pointed back to Rome. It was sort of like a halfway shuffle to the left, returning to the Roman Church. And they saw William Laud as a papist, which he really wasn't. He wasn't under the thumb of the Pope. But he was an Arminian, and he was convinced of Episcopalian worship. And so they sought to impose that on the Scots, on the Presbyterians. Laud was appointed Archbishop of Canterbury in August of 1633. And that is going to be sort of the beginning point of a long struggle between Scotland and England over the proper type of church government and the proper way to worship God, and other issues that are going to crop up over time. The Bishopric of Edinburgh was appointed in September of that year, 1633. And then in 1636, the Book of Canons, that's C-A-N-O-N-S, and the 1637, the following year, the service book is published, how the services have to be conducted in the Anglican fashion using the Book of Common Prayer and the Book of Canons. And in July of 1637 is when they decide to impose that for the first time at the Great Church of St. Giles in the middle of Edinburgh, just down from the castle. For those of you who have been there, you've been to St. Giles, no doubt. John Knox is buried in the parking lot right behind that great cathedral. And so they brought in the bishops, and they began to read the order of service. And that's, I mentioned last time, that's when Jenny Geddes allegedly grabbed the stool she was sitting on. They didn't have pews. Elderly people typically brought a three-legged milking stool with them, or something similar, camp stool, to sit when they could no longer stand. And a lot of the local people, especially older people, did bring their own stools. And she grabbed hers and hurled it at the bishop's head and said, you're not going to preach papistry in my lug, in my ear, and hurled it at his head. And he ducked as the stool went swirling past his ear, and all of a sudden everybody else decided to do the same thing. And then with a roar, the congregation rushed to the front of the church, and picking up their skirts, they ran for the back. All of the bishops and their assistants, etc., headed for to go out the windows and the back doors, with the crowd chasing them. And they chased them down the street, and thousands of other people came out to find out what the disturbance was and joined in. And it turned into one big riot against the Anglican Church, and they were routed at St. Giles, beginning with a woman who ran a street stall. She sold fish. Some people said she was a fishmonger. Some said she was a craft person of some sort. But anyway, she needed to get another stool later on, because she hurled it at the bishop and started the riot. And it did turn into a riot. Well, that led, in February the following year, to the Presbyterian Churches of Scotland deciding they'd had enough. And they called for a general assembly of the church. All the presbyteries send representatives, and we will gather, and we're going to have a general assembly. Well, the King of England had declared that no assemblies of that type could be organized unless he himself called for that to happen, like the old Roman emperors who would call together a church council. Only the king has the right to do that, according to Charles I. And they ignored him, and they called together this convocation of presbyters. And one of the king sent his man, his Scottish representative, to protest and to stand up in that meeting and tell the presbyters that they had to cease and desist. It was an illegal meeting, and they needed to go home. This was in Glasgow in November of 37. Anyway, the result was that the preeminent preacher at this time in Scotland, or the man who was in a way was looked up to the most, or one of the ones that was looked up to the most, there were a couple of them, got up and thanked the king's representative for trying to for representing the king, expressing his wishes, then said, do I hear a motion from the floor to excommunicate all the bishops in the church? And of course, it didn't take long for that vote to be cast and seconded and unanimously and uproariously passed. And so they excommunicated all the bishops in Scotland just like that. And they sent him packing back to the king you're going to go explain to His Majesty that it's not up to him to call General Assemblies of Christ Kirk, which, of course, he went, which he did. And another principle or another fact that's going to be in every one of these assemblies and controversies is that the king is going to have Scottish subjects that are totally on his side and represent him and are going to sell their lives to destroy Presbyterianism and to assert the royal authority over the church. They are willing to do anything to serve the king, serve the crown. Because when they're successful, they get rewarded. Because the king will take away the castles and the lands of the nobles who support the Presbyterians. Well, the thing is that most of the elders are, a lot of the elders anyway, are nobles. And they also serve in the legislatures. And they own all the land. And so one of the great successes of the Scots, and it becomes known as the Second Scottish Reformation, the Second Reformation. And one of the results of it, of course, is that it's going to be led by some of the nobles, some of the nobility of Scotland is going to be converted and become outstanding presbyters and powerful, politically powerful men. That can raise an army if needs be, and it's going to be needs be in the coming years. There's going to be a lot of fighting, and the nobility is always going to be divided, but there are always going to be men who were on the side of the Kirk and were theologically absolutely reformed. Well, the King of England, when he found out about this General Assembly, decided to call Parliament. Now, Parliament serves at the King's behest in those days, and he calls the Parliament into session, usually because he needs money. The King doesn't have money unless it's given to him by Parliament. Now, these kings tend to be poor compared to the modern kings of England, who are billionaires. But the kings of England then were really dependent upon the nobility to give them money. And the nobility could tax and collect rents of all the people in their parishes because they were in charge and they owned the land. And so when the King of England needed money, he would call the Parliament into session. So he called the Parliament into session. And the problem, of course, is going to be that the majority of Parliament are Puritans. They're not necessarily ministers, but they're men of reformed convictions, theological convictions. And they don't like the king as head of church either. And they get called into session, and the king says, I need money to raise an army to attack Scotland and force them to comply. And that parliament is known as the Short Parliament because the king realized he wasn't going to get anything from these guys, and so he dismisses Parliament. The next Parliament's going to be called the Long Parliament because they're going to ignore the king. The next time they're called into session, they're going to bully the king, and they're going to stay in session through all the English civil wars, and they're not going to give him a penny to take an army to Scotland. So the king is able to raise enough money from the nobility that support him to put together an army, and he marches on Scotland. And he's met at the border by a Scottish army of Covenanters that is about three times the size of the English army. And they're quite willing to have it out on the battlefield if that's what he wants. And he realizes that's not going to go well. And it's called the Bishop's War, and no shots were fired. They made a deal, and the English went home. We won't wipe you out, and you get to go home. And so the English went home. That's how that worked out. Well, in the meantime, after the assembly, after the General Assembly that really reasserted the Church of Scotland as Presbyterian, the next thing that occurred was an assembly in which they presented the National Covenant. And it's a document that's going to result in all the signatories being called covenanters. And you'll hear that word bandied about in our denomination and in a few other Reformed Presbyterian denominations. Because what the covenanters did, the National Covenant was drawn by up by a lawyer, Lord Warriston, who was a lawyer, drew it up, and it was presented by a pastor who was also the moderator of the General Assembly, and his name was Henderson. And Henderson is going to be really the foremost preacher in Scotland for the next 5 or 6 years, and he is going to be a Scottish commissioner to the Westminster Assembly in England, which we will be talking about in the coming weeks, and is very, very important to our history. So between Henderson and Lord Warriston, they drew up the National Covenant, which said the king is God's man in the area of civil authority. But Christ is the head of the church, and the Bible is where we get all the rules and the regulations for the worship, the proper worship of God. And that was a revolutionary document. Now, John Knox had drawn one up, and they had a National Covenant back in the 16th century. So it's not a new concept, and it's not unknown. But now it's been revised and made more reformed. And what it is the nation of Scotland signing a covenant that they are going to, that as a people, they are going to acknowledge Christ as the king of the church and of the nation. And that the king is subordinate to Christ, and he's also subject to church discipline, because that is the role of the church and the people that are members of the church. And so the National Covenant's composed in a church just around the corner and down the street from St. Giles, Greyfriars Kirk. And the National Covenant is laid out in the front of the church on a table. And it's signed first by the nobility. The nobles of Edinburgh, of region, come and sign it. And then the pastors from all the churches sign it. And then all the people start signing it. And they have to make copy after copy after copy and carry them around Scotland. And thousands and thousands of people signed the National Covenant. And I mean, men and women, pastors, deacons, elders, and all the common folk, church members, thousands and thousands of them signed the National Covenant. And you still see these framed in different places around Scotland, although now they're totally embarrassed by their existence. And some of the people pricked their fingers and signed it with their blood. When they took the covenant, when they took the National Covenant, said Christ is the king, they were serious. And they said, our nation is a Christian nation, and we're subject to the law of God. They were serious. They meant what they said. And thousands of them are going to die as a result of it, in battle and in execution and in prison over the next 40 years. Many of them are going to pay for that signature, just like signing the Declaration of Independence. They were pledging their lives and their sacred honor, come what may, and may came to the Covenanters when the crown was able to reassert its authority and send armies that were able to subdue the Christians of Scotland. And so the National Covenant, though, then became this basic document of Scottish liberty and Scottish freedom of worship and all the things that went with it. And we'll pick up there next week. Another covenant is going to be drawn up shortly thereafter, called the Solemn League and Covenant. And it's a little bit different than the National Covenant. and it's also part of the Covenanter heritage, but it has to do with the state being subject to Christ and his word. Okay, thank you. Well, that's what we're going to talk